Chapter 14. Early in the morning of the 14th day, there were many small sharks playing around the boat. They were between 3 and 4 feet long, with an occasional big one that ran to 6 or 7 feet. Obviously, they were after the small fish which clustered about us constantly now, feeding on the moss which had begun to grow on the bottom of the raft. At this time, there were about a dozen of these beautifully colored tropical species swimming about, now and then disappearing beneath us in their search for food. Gene was vigilant with his knife, trying to repeat his feat of gilling one. Sometimes, when Gene became tired, I took the knife, and several times I came pretty close to getting one of the sharks, but I was more optimistic of spearing a smaller fish. They came within reach frequently as they made for the food growing on the raft's bottom. Then a leopard shark, about 7 feet long, cruised up and frightened all the smaller sharks away. He seemed more interested in the boat than in his natural prey. He slid around the boat several times, about 100 feet away, with his dorsal fin sailing high out of the water. After he looked us over a while, he swept directly under the boat, diving to about 2 feet beneath the surface. If I had had the pistol, I could have shot him as he returned slowly, at a speed of 3 or 4 knots. I was not pleased at his scaring those prospective meals away, the smaller sharks and fish. I thought I'd better chase him off. "Tony," I said, "hand me the gun." Pistol ready, I waited. I figured that the leopard shark would go around the boat and try swimming under us again. Sure enough, he passed under the boat, swung out about 20 yards, circled around to the leeward side, and headed straight in toward the boat again as before. I threw the pistol off safe and got ready, not moving for fear of scaring him as he moved in. This time he did not sound, but approached smoothly and deliberately, straight down the wake of the boat. He almost stopped when his head was directly below my pointed pistol. The muzzle was only about 4 inches above his forehead. Quickly centering my aim, I pulled the trigger. It never occurred to me that I might be firing too close to the water. When I pulled the trigger, water shot up like steam and threw my hand about 2 feet in the air. The blast almost blew the gun from my hand, but somehow I managed to maintain my grip. The muzzles, being so close to the surface, blew a fine shower into the air from the powder charge, and it was a second or two before I could see what had happened to the shark. When things cleared away, he was down about 10 feet, spinning around and down like a corkscrew. He was sounding as rapidly as he could, and these sharks had tremendous power. He was gaining momentum at every twist of his sinewy body. Evidently, I had wounded him mortally. I never saw him again. I had hoped to kill him, but I learned later that a shark's brain is more toward his nose than I had aimed. I probably broke his spinal column. In a very short space, there was a whole pack of sharks around. I assumed that they had already polished off their wounded fellow and were looking for further prey, as they did each morning and evening when the fish were feeding. We were disappointed at having killed fair game and yet being unable to claim it for a meal. About this time, we were beginning to notice a deterioration in our physical condition. All of us were losing weight, rapidly now. We were long, wiry types. I was the heaviest, weighing about 180 pounds when we started. So far, however, we had borne up very well, but now our experience was about to take its toll. That was plain. We were not downhearted, yet. With each passing day, we felt our chances were better of being rescued by a convoy. We knew that many of them must be passing through these waters. Of course, when war broke out, our vessels were forced to swing wide of the regular trade routes because the Japs were in possession of the Marshalls and other groups of islands in that area. At that particular time, the enemy was just about sitting astraddle of the beaten path to the Orient through this way. We also knew that we were rapidly approaching the more southerly groups of islands, where our chances of making a landfall would be good. However, the particular stretch of sea that we were crossing now was almost entirely devoid of islands, I knew. Rescue by a convoy would be luck, we realized. Our best chance was still to keep working southward, holding on to life until we hit an island, whenever and wherever that might be. Aldrich's earlier success in catching fish spurred his efforts now. Hour after hour, he leaned over the side of the boat, stabbing at every swimming creature that came anywhere near his reach. He made many attempts, and though he was unsuccessful, his patience never gave out. On this 14th day, he was rewarded. A small specimen, exactly like the first, got a little too near the boat, and Jean's long brown arm sprung out like a snake's tongue. He drew it back triumphantly with the fish impaled on the knife in his hand. Our hunger had been very intense the 4 or 5 days after eating the shark, but was now beginning to subside. A dangerous sign, I thought. We had been getting drinking water fairly regularly, thanks to the squalls, so we were able to eat this fish with relish, and, I might add, without delay. Aldrich, throughout the rest of the day, redoubled his efforts to land another fish, but without success. He put away the knife regretfully when darkness fell. That night it rained again. The comforts and discomforts brought by rain had become routine. We didn't talk so often now, but went about our duties automatically as circumstances called. The shower tonight was fairly heavy. We had our drink, then bailed by our cumbersome sop-and-ring method until the boat was empty. The shower over, we wrung out our clothes and hauled them on again with little comment. We were getting tired. A few minutes after the shower ended, I lay down in the bottom of the boat to try again to rest. I closed my eyes, although it was very dark. Suddenly, I became conscious of a scratching noise on the stern of the boat, just above my head. I opened my eyes to see what was causing the noise. It was a bird, calmly perched there. Neither Jean nor Tony appeared to be aware of our visitor. Very carefully and noiselessly, I slid my hand up inside and as close to the edge of the boat as I could, without taking a chance of causing some slight scraping sound on the fabric. Then I quickly grabbed and had him by the leg. The flapping and squawking and general commotion that immediately ensued brought the boys to my assistance. Jean and Tony whooped in their excitement, but were as careful and methodical in their movement as I was, as I concentrated every bit of my brain and body on holding on to that bird. In a moment, Jean and Tony held it securely. Jean took his knife, grasped the bird by the beak and face, and efficiently cut off its head with a deft stroke. It was a small bird. "Ain't another albatross, is it?" Tony asked. We were all feeling about its feathers in the darkness. "Not too small," Jean said. "Well, I'm afraid it's too dark to do anything with it until morning," I said. "Better let me stow it away in the bow," Jean advised. Stow it he did, amidst a clamor of speculation and delight. There was more conversation that night than we had had in several days, as we impatiently awaited the morning. We examined the bird in the gray light before dawn. It was a young tern of some sort. We picked off his feathers and proceeded to eat. The little fish of the previous day had reawakened our dormant appetites, and we were ravenous. The tern's flesh was tender. To me, it tasted like dried chicken. Of course, by now we were over any squeamishness we had felt at the start about eating raw flesh.